Hello, everyone, and welcome back to another day here at the Damage Report as we continue through these Supreme Court hearings that we should totally be having just 3 weeks before an election which something like 10 million people have already voted. Nothing wrong with any of this. And so we're going to be responding to a few of the standout little clips and quotes from those hearings. But who's we? It's me. But far more importantly, Adrienne Lawrence joins us once again on the show.
Hey, John, thanks so much for having me. It has been a wild day.
Yeah, it's okay. Very glad to have you here. Can't wait to hear what you think. Because obviously, we come at these sorts of hearings from a very different perspective. So we're going to be talking not only about some of the things that she said today, but we're also going to be talking about some of what we can learn from her past, actually. And so we're going to be talking about that too. How are you doing? 3 weeks to the day before the election. It is almost on us.
You know what? I get a little bit more afraid by every day, but at some point you kind of just say, there's nothing I can do. Shoulder shrugs. I just have to prepare for the war of 2020 and keep it moving.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I'm just wondering, 3 weeks from now, what is election week going to look like? Is it going to be a big day? And we're all like tense. Oh my God, these legal challenges are going to be crazy. Oh, wait, no, Biden took Florida. He took Texas. This thing is not even debatable. Or is it going to be the worst week of our media lives? I don't know.
Oh, I think it's going to be the absolute worst week in its entirety.
That's what you're predicting?
Absolutely. Yeah. And really setting up that opportunity to challenge whatever the election results will be, especially if they're not in his favor.
Well, look, at the very least, what's that?
By him, I mean Trump, of course.
Yes, of course. We'll see. But no matter what, we will be here together. We have that. We have nothing else, but we have that. So that's good. So what are we going to be talking about? Obviously, the hearings. We've already mentioned that. We're going to do a little bit of a roundup of all of the ways that it's been made more difficult for people to vote or even register to vote. Cords are being cut and stuff like that. We're going to be talking about all of this. Mitch McConnell debated Amy McGrath yesterday. That was something. We're going to talk about that too. I also wanted to let people know about one or two things coming up soon. So today is the big T.Y. Tarantino TYT special, where people who have worked with TYT for many years. I actually shouldn't even be in this because there's like the only real gap in all the faces you're seeing right now is from whoever was second to last to me. So it's nice that they included me. But those other 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 are literally the first 6 employees ever for TYT. So we're going to be talking about not politics really, but about what our lives might be like had we not gotten involved with TYT. We're going to Tarantino it. We're going to do a little bit of an alternate history, an alternate present. And that is going to start at 7:30 p.m. Eastern time, 4:30 p.m. Pacific time. Available on YouTube and Facebook, Twitch, YouTube TV, Samsung Plus, PlayStation, probably, I don't know. Maybe your Switch. Doesn't have Netflix, might have our special. But anyway, I'm going to be on the last hour, but you should definitely tune in for all of those. I think Cenk, Anna, and myself are going to be doing 1 hour of that. So that should be a lot of fun. Adrienne, how long have you been involved with TYT, and how did you actually get involved with TYT? These things all blur together. What was your beginning?
It really does start to feel like forever, because I was just thinking about this the other day. I can tell you that JR is the reason I am a part of this. He recruited me, which was super cool. I do not specifically remember when, but I think it was either 2018 or maybe early 2019. But I can tell you, and I'm not in any way, you know, pandering. It was one of the best places, and it has been one of the best places that I've ever been. Just awesome. The collegial nature of everything, I'm happy.
Awesome, thank you. And it has been made far better by you being involved. And I can't believe that it might have only been 2 years. It certainly feels like a lot longer than that. Although 2020 has been a decade long, so that might be part of it. But very glad to have you here. I also wanted to let people know, yesterday on the program, we knew that the first Dragon Squad t-shirt was coming, but it wasn't ready for the show, but it is here now. So let's debut it for the first time on the show, designed by Carlos Godoy, the first ever Dragon Squad t-shirt available now. at shoptyt.com. You can go pick that up. Many of you last week were very enthusiastic about the first Damage Report shirt ever. And I'm not saying anything, I'm just saying it's the best selling shirt on Shop2IT all year. No big deal. I'm just saying it's only been available for a week, but it's the biggest, it's the best. Thank you for making that happen. Let's see if we can get the Dragon Squad t-shirt up there as well. That'll be a strong message sent to Shop2IT that there's an appetite. But anyway, there's other stuff we're gonna be talking about. We actually gonna debut a little bit later on the show. Editor Cassie put together a Pets of TDR mashup of all the different pets that have shown up on the show. So we're gonna be showing that a bit later on. I don't have my dog here to show, but we are gonna be showing some digital fur babies a little bit later on. And with that, you ready to do this thing, Adrian?
Let's get it going. I can dig it.
Awesome. One last thing. Please hit the like button if you haven't already. Share the stream. You can send in messages, super chats, tweets, all that, and we'll be responding as we go. And now, let's do this thing. We are in day two of the Supreme Court nomination hearings for Amy Coney Barrett. And you should be tuning in so that you can find out all of the different things that she won't tell you what she thinks about or how she'll rule or literally anything. If you want to learn nothing, tune in live. But that doesn't mean that we haven't learned anything, just mostly through her not opining. So as an example of that, here's an important one. What does she think about Trump trying to delay the election? Sort of as a placeholder for all these questions about what Trump might be willing to do around the election. Well, here's Dianne Feinstein asking about that.
Does the Constitution give the President of the United States the authority to unilaterally delay a general election under any circumstances? Does federal law?
Well, Senator, if that question ever came before me, I would need to hear arguments from the litigants and read briefs and consult with my law clerks and talk to my colleagues and go through the opinion writing process. So, you know, if I give off the cuff answers, then I would be basically a legal pundit. And I don't think we want judges to be legal pundits. I think we want judges to approach cases thoughtfully and with an open mind.
Okay, so you know, Adrian, you're the expert. What do you think about that? How should we respond to her not, she didn't give anything away about what she thinks about Trump and the election there.
Okay, so generally judges do not opine on how they would rule in the future when they are Supreme Court nominees sitting before Congress in a confirmation hearing. That is very much standard practice to punt for many reasons. In part, it also kind of violates judicial ethics to talk about how you would rule. And so that makes sense. But for her not to address something that is outlined in the Constitution and is clear about who has the power to extend these elections, that's signaling a little bit of problems here. But there were a few other instances in which she could have answered something because it is a set fact and she decided to punt.
Yeah, so look, you're being very fair there, and I get it. She can't, like, it would to say, can he do that sounds specific, but in reality, it's probably not very specific, and she would need to know the ins and outs of the blah, 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 and specifically all that stuff. But she didn't say anything about the role of the president in affecting the timing or, you know, nature of the election. Like, she wouldn't give anything away. And while I agree that obviously she can't say certain things. At a certain point, as we're to go through more of these that she won't say what she actually thinks, it makes me wonder then what is the point of these hearings? If she won't give us any idea of what her philosophy is other than some sort of vague assertion that she's going to go with the original word of the Constitution, the original word of the Constitution, which by the way would leave her unable to vote, let alone hold a seat on the Supreme Court, which seems like an implicit acknowledgement that there are fundamental problems there that maybe we should continue to look into. She's gonna pretend that we don't have to while obviously missing that big one. Others remain. So what's the point of these hearings? Is it just supposed to be her weathering the storm until they get to put her on there? Is there no role for the people to actually learn who these people that they don't get to vote on that are gonna hold that position for 50 plus years actually believe about all this?
You know what? I believe that this is an opportunity for them to see how she operates under pressure. It's a question of whether members of Congress are gonna do anything with that information. We got to see how Brett Kavanaugh was handled in his very juvenile antics and aggressive behavior and nastiness. That should have told members of Congress enough about how they need to vote when it comes to him being a nominee. And we get to see her, Amy Coney Barrett, up here. And also we get to see the lengths to which her knowledge, the breadth of it. And it is expansive. And also, again, she's not working off of any notes. And also her ability to recall, to articulate, to have these conversations, to remain poised. Those are things that you would want from a judge. And so she definitely has more of the performative behavioral aspects down, which is something that members of Congress take into account.
Yeah, you know, before we move on to other issues that she wouldn't tell us what she actually thinks about, I am curious what you think about the concept that she's gone around about originalism, how she's gonna interpret. My issue for a very long time has been that one, there's like you can say that is your judicial philosophy, but there's nothing in the Constitution that says that judges need to look at the Constitution in that way. So hypothetically, that just seems like your choice, man, to me. The other is that it seems as if they're saying, I'm going to go with the specific wording of the Constitution, but the Constitution is notoriously vague and ill-defined on very important topics. Now, I've never been to law school. I don't really know anything about anything, but those seem like pretty big issues.
No, and you're absolutely right. It is completely the judge's choice in terms of what kind of legal theories they want to apply and the lens that they want to use. And she chooses to use the lens of this originalist thought of let me put myself in the position of the framers of the Constitution and figure out how they would have interpreted things. And that can be very limiting in part because, well, we know the original framers were white men who enjoyed oppression and hypocrisy. And so to actually put yourself in their positions and then use that to interpret the language of the text itself is very problematic because we no longer live in a world where their mentality should be dominant. And she also uses something that Gorsuch uses, which Scalia did use as well, which is this textualism, which means I'm gonna look at the plain language of what's written in those words. And the problematic nature of that is that you are literally just taking the plain language. Not a big deal or not a big fan of legislative history in terms of what did Congress say about this behind closed doors or in hearings to try to understand what they meant from this word. Instead, let's just see what the plain language is. And that is also very limiting. It's a very hands-off approach, both of them, originalism and textualism, but this is what she prefers.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. I would argue that I think it's just a smokescreen. Like you can't take the plain language of all of the various references to political speech in the Constitution when whole technologies didn't exist. The plain language has nothing to say about these things because the people who were writing this could never have conceived of these technologies or platforms or anything even existing, let alone the fundamental issue of just saying, let's just go with whatever these guys wanted when many of them owned slaves, raped slaves, dueled and murdered people. There are some fundamental ethical issues with them as individuals to begin with. Yeah, I have an issue with it. On the content of the video that we saw though, I only wanted to add once more, it's not gonna come as news to anyone watching the show, but it's in the top three biggest issues and it's the number one short-term issue with Amy Coney Barrett is, I don't think that Trump would have signed off on her being the nominee if she hadn't been very explicit about what she was going to do with any election related cases that came before her. If she's railroaded onto the Supreme Court in the next week or two, and then he starts challenging things. That's me again as a legal nobody. Adrian, what do you think about the prospects that she could be on the court to rule on election related cases involving the president who just put her on the court?
Okay. So I definitely think that could happen. My hope, and it may be naive or wishful thinking, is that she'll turn out to kind of be an Earl Warren, where she does this whole, I'm a Republican, let's get this done, you know, put me on the court, and I'm gonna do exactly what you want me to. And then once on the court, all of a sudden, it's just unleashing all democracy and doing the right thing. I'm praying that because Earl Warren did it and it was so beautiful. You know, he gave us Brown v. Board, Miranda v. Arizona. The civil liberties that we have in part today come from a man who was the Republican governor of California. He was putting the Japanese in internment camps, which he apologized for, and a lot of other things. But the moment he got on that court, my God, did he render justice and democracy in a beautiful way. And so I am praying that Amy Coney Barrett will embody that same spirit, get on that court and do the right thing. Because the reality is, we just saw Gorsuch write this opinion for the Supreme Court, extending Title VII civil rights law, workplace discrimination to LGBTQ. And Gorsuch is supposed to be Republican. He went against the Trump administration. He's also a contextualist or textualism and originalist. So you never know where they could go once they get that full lifetime appointment of being on SCOTUS.
So no, that's really interesting though. But let me ask you, is that just a hope, like disconnected from everything? Or is there anything about her specifically, her experience, her rulings, anything that lead you to have that hope? Is it a grounded hope is basically what
I'm asking? No, it's just wishful thinking. Oh. If we've seen anything from her rulings, she goes full on conservative. So the thought she might break course, who knows? Because also the reality is that Justice Ginsburg was pretty conservative, a little bit less spicy in her rulings until Sandra Day O'Connor left. And also we've seen Chief Justice Roberts now become that swing vote. So you never know, once they get up there, they could go full throttle. Because what you gonna do to me is the mindset that some of these judges get when they get up there. And so I am praying, and this again, not grounded in anything, but my hopes of hopes, but hey, 2020 cannot take hope from me. Keep it alive.
That's amazing. Okay, I will have that hope as one component of what I am, the broken shell that I am. It'll have a little bit of that hope floating around it. But let's go to another big issue. Many people worry that Amy Coney Barrett on the Supreme Court could finally accomplish what Republicans have been pushing for more than a half a century, which is overturning Roe v. Wade, which all of them are now saying that's totally not why we're putting her on there. Wink, wink. Here she is being asked about it this morning by Dianne Feinstein.
Do you agree with Justice Scalia's view that Roe was wrongly decided?
Senator, I completely understand why you are asking the question, but again, I can't pre-commit or say, yes, I'm going in with some agenda, because I'm not. I don't have any agenda. I have no agenda to try to overrule Casey. I have an agenda to stick to the rule of law and decide cases as they come.
Well, what I'm, as a person, I don't know if you'll answer this one either. Do you agree with Justice Scalia's view that Roe can and should be overturned by the Supreme Court?
Well, I think my answer is the same, because, you know, that's a case that's litigated. It could, you know, its contours could come up again. In fact, do come up. You know, they came up last term before the court. So I think, you know, what the Casey standard is, and that's just, it's a contentious issue, which is, I know, one reason why it would be comforting to you to have an answer. But I can't express views on cases or pre-commit to approaching a case any particular way.
Okay, so I have thoughts, but Adrian, you first. What did you think about that?
Well, I think she took the punt that she had to take and that she should take. I do have concerns, however, very much about Roe v. Wade. And because the real attack is on Planned Parenthood v. Casey, which was the case that came after Roe v. Wade that kind of really set the foundation for what the abortion rights that we have as of right now. I don't know what to think, because we do need a strong precedent set. We also need states and legislature to pass laws that are concrete. And yeah, because it's going to be scary when we have judges out here using this originalism and textualism methods to make these decisions, because they're just going to leave us minorities, whether gender, racial, or sexual minorities, at a loss.
So I really want to hear your opinion on this, because to me, so we just played two clips. We played the clip about the election, we played the clip about this. Her answer was basically the same. And it seems like the evasion is, I can't pre-commit to a particular decision. Okay, that's fine. But those questions were not the same. One was, if a case about Trump specifically delaying the election comes to you, what do you think about that? That's a hypothetical. It's sort of asking you to pre-commit. Asking you if you think that a 50-year-old Supreme Court decision was wrongly decided is not pre-committing to any particular pending or future case. It is, a sort of, I would assume there's not a single person who's graduated law school, has become a judge, is thinking about getting on the Supreme Court that doesn't have an opinion on whether Roe v. Wade was rightly or wrongly decided. She has that opinion. She just won't tell us what it is. We know what like Scalia said not long ago, but she won't tell us. So for me, that answer is absolute BS. That is just trying to hide what you think about Roe v. Wade, not pre-committing to any particular case, but hiding what you view about an entire area of law. What do you think about that?
You know, and I think you're absolutely right, because she does have a decision. The thing that I think she's avoiding getting into is the nuance with that decision. Because if you were to ask me if a landmark decision was rightly decided or wrongly, there are different understandings of what's right and wrong. If we're talking legally, did they follow stare decisis? Did they follow all of the line of cases that had already been touching upon this issue? No, they broke away from it. That's how we got these monumental decisions like Brown v. Board and Miranda v. Arizona and Roe v. Wade, because you had a court that decided, nah, we're gonna spin things up, we're gonna change it now and do what we know to be right based on what the people need, because we essentially can't wait for Congress to pass the right laws. Mm-hmm. But legally, the decision, no, it wasn't done correctly because it didn't follow the rules, but it did the right thing in terms of advancing society. So you get in this nuanced situation of, well, what hat do you want me to argue wearing this? Do you want me to argue this as a person, or do you want me to argue this as a lawyer who says that the rules need to follow a certain path? And so that's where things get very difficult for these Supreme Court nominees, because it's too nuanced to have these discussions with members of Congress who oftentimes are, you know, shenanigans, and they're looking for a good opportunity to catch you slipping so that they're gonna be a soundbite.
Yeah, I don't know. For me, it's the collision between, we're gonna give you a lifetime position. This is our one chance, and it's not a chance. Hypothetically, it could be a chance. In this case, it's not a chance to decide whether you belong on the court or not. And if you get on, then you're there for, you know, Dianne Feinstein will be dead and buried for literally decades before Amy Coney Barrett ever leaves the Supreme Court. And you're not gonna let us know what you think about very important rights that more than 50% of the American public now have access to, but that access could be taken away. That just doesn't seem like, if we got the Ro-Khanna Supreme Court with every president getting to nominate two and they have 18-year terms or whatever, okay, maybe you could be a little bit more like Heidi with your opinions, but it's insane when the people don't get to weigh in. They're literally not even being given the option with the election that's currently ongoing, and you're on there forever. It doesn't seem like it should be acceptable that in these areas, like she knows if she wants to overturn Roe v. Wade or not. I understand that we have this mythology built up where every single human being is a base partisan tribal person, except for those who want to go on the Supreme Court. They don't have any goals, no ideology. They don't care about politics. They haven't supported or opposed any politicians. They don't have a dog like in the fight of any given election. They're just these angelic scholarly beings who only have philosophies. And it's just I almost said it. It's BS. We deserve a straight answer. That's all I'm saying.
I get you. But also, I really feel the system is set up so that they can't give a straight answer. And also the level of nuance that involved. And I feel like it could become more political than it needs to be. I like the idea of them opining. I love the theory. I love how smart she is. I love how smart the vast majority of these justices are. At the same time, I don't want them there because all they do is hold us back in terms of not having a progressive mindset. But then again, people would argue that I have a different framework, which is true. I don't believe in, let's use the vantage point of someone from the 1700s.
Yeah, yeah. Adrienne Lawrence for Supreme Court. Let's talk about that. We were just talking about having sort of a progressive ideology, okay? Which means a lot of things in different areas, but it could mean something on the SCOTUS. Let's see if we can get an idea of what she thinks about different sort of issues that are, I would say, relevant in America today. So first, we have a tweet from John Haltwanger of Business Insider, who quoted her saying, racism persists in our country, but she won't put her finger on whether it's outright or systemic racism. She says, these are policy questions that are beyond what she's capable of addressing as a judge. Thoughts?
I thought that was a blatant punt Because I think that that's more of an like an observation that you can make, whether it's structural racism, institutionalized, all of these forms of racism. And if she just said, you know what, I'm not a sociologist, I can't speak to that specifically, but from the context in which I know and answer the question. But I can't see this as being something that she could have answered and not gotten in considerable trouble for from the conservative end. I think that this was a punt, and I don't think it was a legit one at all, that it was playing on party line.
Yeah, I feel like it's much like the comparison we made between the first two videos. This isn't about a hypothetical case, isn't about a specific case. Do you think that racism is baked into the structure of American government, American society, the American economy, those sorts of things? Now, your views on that could affect what you do as a justice. We could speculate about what effect that might have, but that's a fairly foundational thing about your understanding of America. And if you won't say that you think it's there, I think it's fair to assume that you don't think that it's there. And when she goes on to say that she cried with her family over the death of George Floyd and had to explain things about his killing, as if this was the first she'd heard of it, to me, it says a lot.
No, I know, because I was initially thinking, gosh, you hadn't had this conversation with your kids before. How are you going to be a parent to black children, a black little girl and boy, and not have had these conversations about racism? And also too, if you are anti-racist, why haven't you had this conversation with your white children too? So it did catch me off. And it was also, it really felt very performative for her to have her kids there to begin with. So to weaponize and use them and to essentially convey in these subtle ways that I'm not racist because I have these two children I adopted from Haiti. You may be the nicest person ever and still have issues with unconscious bias. And to not acknowledge or recognize or show any appreciation for that is very problematic.
Yeah. Other things that might be problematic, here's a quote from her having to do with the LGBTQ community. A quote, I have never discriminated on the basis of sexual preference and would never discriminate on the basis of sexual preference, which this reporter acknowledges is not true because she was on the board of a school that refused to accept the children of same-sex couples. So it's just a lie. But in addition, I don't know what year it is. It's not a preference. It's not like I'm more of a hot dog than a hamburger kind of guy. I like Red Vines more than Twizzlers. This ain't about preference. This is about who you are and the rights that you have. And if you're using the language of decades ago, my fear, and you're participating in this discrimination, my fear is that that is what you actually think about this community. You think it's a bunch of people that have sort of a preference or whatever, which does not sound like the worldview that leads to you holding up those people's rights going forward. That would be my fear, Adrian.
Oh, absolutely. You know, for her to pretend that there's some kind of evolving preferential treatment kind of thought that I can do whatever I want with my sexual identity, as opposed to this being an orientation, that this is an immutable characteristic about myself that cannot change. It very much scares me because it speaks to the lens by which she will see gay, lesbian, LGBTQ, trans rights by thinking that this is a choice as opposed to a part of your identity and who you are. And so that is very scary. And that, I think, it is one of those reflection elements that make you think, wow, this person may be very smart and wow, they may have this legal theory that they cast their lens through, but now she's showing her true bias.
You know, she also said, and this is sort of related to that, she said this about this, but she said it about other things too. So asked about the possibility that a case coming before the Supreme Court that could hypothetically overturn the relatively recent nationwide right for same-sex marriage, she says the most likely result is that a case like that wouldn't make it to the Supreme Court. But she says if lower courts flout precedent, it could come back up. You're gonna be on the Supreme Court for decades past when I hope to be flying around in spaceships. You're gonna be there for a while. Let's not like totally get into, I don't think it'll happen in the next 40 plus years. A lot can happen in that time. And she said this about a case that might overturn same-sex marriage. She said it about many things involving the ACA. She won't tell us much of what she thinks, except that she sure has thoughts about what would never make it before the Supreme Court. I mean, Adrian, Republicans aren't gonna be trying to get rid of same-sex marriage in 1 or 5 or 20 years. They'll have moved on by then.
You know what, I found that response that she gave to be very nonsensical, because the reality is that Trump has stacked the deck when we talk about judges. He's now appointed almost a quarter of all active federal judges in the United States. And as we recently saw with the DC Court of Appeals, that decision that initially came down, unfortunately the name escapes me, but essentially you had a panel of three judges, two of whom were conservative, one appointed by Trump, where they totally issued a decision that was not consistent at all with the rules of the law. And the DC Court of Appeals had to come through and issue a ruling en banc to get rid of it. And that is a problem when you're going to have these Trump judges making rulings and decisions that are consistent with Trump's policy efforts as opposed to applying the exact law. And that is what's going to happen, where we will get judges who go ahead and say, yeah, let's go ahead and allow that this law to go through that, hey, it oppresses LGBTQ. And then the next judge, oh yeah, sounds good. And then it gets to SCOTUS. Yeah. So it's ridiculous to act like this will never happen when Trump has stacked the judiciary.
We need to talk about a relatively new show called the Republic, or UNFTR. As a Young Turks fan, you already know that the government, the media, and corporations are constantly peddling lies that serve the interests of the rich and powerful. But now there's a podcast dedicated to unraveling those lies, debunking the conventional wisdom. In each episode of the Republic, or UNFTR, the host delves into a different historical episode or topic that's generally misunderstood or purposely obfuscated by the so-called powers that be, featuring in-depth research, razor-sharp commentary, and just the right amount of vulgarity. The UNFTR podcast takes a sledgehammer to what you thought you knew about some of the nation's most sacred historical cows. But don't just take my word for it. The New York Times described UNFTR as consistently compelling and educational, aiming to challenge conventional wisdom and upend the historical narratives that were taught in school. For as the great philosopher Yoda once put it,
"You must unlearn what you have learned."
And that's true whether you're in Jedi training or you're uprooting and exposing all the propaganda and disinformation you've been fed over the course of your lifetime. So search for UNFDR in your podcast app today and get ready to get informed, angered, and entertained all at the same time.
Amy Coney Barrett is being, you know, grilled to the extent that a bunch of Republicans who just want to put her on the Supreme Court and Dianne Feinstein can do. They're doing their best, I guess. There are some topics that might not come up, but that people definitely need to know about. And one was raised that I saw on Twitter actually by our guest, Adrian. So Adrian, you had tweeted about the fact that she wrote for a unanimous three judge panel back in 2019 that upheld the dismissal of a workplace discrimination lawsuit by Terry Smith, a black Illinois transportation employee who sued after he was fired. He claimed that he was called a racial slur by his supervisor. And Barrett wrote in that the N-word is an egregious racial epithet. That said, Smith can't win simply by proving that the word was uttered. He must also demonstrate that Colbert's use of this word, it's not Stephen Colbert, altered the conditions of his employment and created a hostile or abusive working environment. She seems to be implying there, Adrian, that saying the N-word to your employee does not by itself constitute anything.
Yeah, and as shocking as it may be, that is the law. The bar has been set so high by the judiciary to win on workplace discrimination claims, whether they be age discrimination, sexual harassment, or race discrimination, or all the forms of discrimination. The bar is so incredibly high. And it's set that way because, unfortunately, this is a white male patriarchal world, and the Civil Rights Act was kind of a way to appease the civil rights movement and to hopefully quell the unrest. But in practice, as in when people actually bring cases before the courts and the judiciary, the judges have essentially created this whole case law that says you really have to endure significant abuse and intolerable behavior in order to win in a workplace discrimination case. So Amy Coney Barrett was applying the law. I was very almost defensive about this point on Twitter and social media because this opinion isn't a reflection of Amy Coney Barrett. That'd be naive to think that, and it'd also be a very limited mindset of assuming she's the evil one. No, the entire state of the law is evil, and the way it is set up to work against the employee. And so we need people to understand that this is so much bigger than Amy Coney Barrett. She is merely applying the law, because the law is what is against people.
Well, look, I think that you're right, but I'm gonna add a little wrinkle. So you're saying it's not her that's evil, it's the system that's evil, because this is baked into the system. But she says, I can't say whether the evil is baked into the system. So she's going along with it, but she won't even acknowledge that it's there.
Exactly, because we just saw in her confirmation hearing where she was like, not gonna be able to say, is it structural, you know? And I thought that was an unnecessary punt. And so I do see these two things as separate, but they definitely intertwine and connect. Because on one hand, in this opinion, she is applying the case law. And for her to diverge from it would potentially be problematic, or she'd just be in the dissent in this case. But when she's before the hearing and her refusal to acknowledge racism being structural, you know, being in the system, I think that that's problematic, because she's just ignoring the facts and what we know this world to be.
Yeah, so look, I'm glad that you're here to add all of that context, because I did not know quite a bit of this. Yeah, when she goes on to say that Smith, quote, introduced no evidence that Colbert's use of the N-word changed his subjective experience of the workplace. I guess that's the law. It seems to me like it's not up to me to say whether that changes someone's subjective experience. If they say that it does, I don't know how much evidence people should have to provide that it does. I don't think I get to decide that. I don't think that Amy Coney Barrett gets to decide that, but apparently they do get to decide that.
Yeah, it's one of the interesting elements. You have to show subjective that it changed your outlook, crazy. That it made you fearful of working there, that it upset you in some way. And that's the thing, is the law is so, it can be so nuanced at times and also so particular. But of course, the judges are the ones that say whether you have it or don't have it, and they'll call you out on little things, or maybe they'll give you a pass on it. And that's unfortunate.
So one extra thing, and now I'm actually very interested to see what you hear about this, although you're probably well aware of this. Justice Brett Kavanaugh, then serving as a federal appeals court judge in Washington, DC, said one utterance was enough, quote, but in my view, being called the N-word by a supervisor suffices by itself to establish a racially hostile work environment. The epithet has been labeled variously a term that sums up all the bitter years of insult and struggle in America, pure anathema to African Americans, and quote, probably the most offensive word in English. No other word in the English language so powerfully or instantly calls to mind our country's long and brutal struggle to overcome racism and discrimination against African Americans. In short, the case law demonstrates that a single sufficiently severe incident may create a hostile work environment actionable under federal anti-discrimination law. So that's all Brett Kavanaugh. So based on what you've said, he's wrong there?
No, that's the thing. They're in two different circuits. And that is why the law, you don't know what you're gonna get and you don't know where you are. She was coming from the Seventh Circuit, where I believe there are 12 judges on that circuit. 10 were appointed by Republicans and our conservative judges. He's coming from the DC Circuit Court, which is definitely a lot more diverse in terms of thinking. And so you could go to the Second Circuit, the First, the Ninth, they're all different. And that's the problem, because then you end up having a case, hopefully making its way to the Supreme Court. And the Supreme Court is the one that gets to decide what's going to be the law in the land. Because really the law differs from place to place, but the general frame of mind and the general thought in the vast majority of circuits is that one racial epithet isn't enough. And especially because that person, it seemed, did not explain how it subjectively changed their outlook at the workplace. Because for instance, you know, somebody who may be black may say the N-word to me as a greeting and it doesn't bother me. And that's very different from hearing it maybe from a white colleague who I'm not close with. I have to show that it subjectively changed my outlook and that it changed how I felt about my work environment.
Sure. Okay, you're fair. And you know, there's a comment. Well, I know, and that's why, this is why we need you on here, because I don't have the training to add all this. I can only give what I consider to be common sense, which is mostly like, to all of this. But Stan Z sent in a super chat saying, I'm so grateful for Adrian dropping all this legal knowledge on us. I learn so much every time she's on the show. Stan Z, me too. Add me onto that. Donald Trump, fresh off coronavirus, assuming he's not still positive for it, is back to holding his massive super spreader rallies. And I know what you're wondering, has he learned something? Has he changed in some way based on his experience? Well, I'll let him do the talking.
Thing with me, the nice part, I went through it. Now they say I'm immune. I feel so powerful. I'll walk into that audience. I'll walk in there, I'll kiss everyone in that audience. I'll kiss the guys and the beautiful women and them. Everybody, I'll just give you a big fat kiss.
I don't know what is wrong with him. I don't know if it's the steroids. I don't know if it's just him being him. That was a bunch of nonsense and it makes me sad. Fundamentally, on a deep level, it makes me sad.
It's like he's already admitted to being a sexual assailant. And now he's like, yeah, and I'm going to come for you too. I'm going to get the men's, I'm going to get the women's and the children. And it's just really disturbing that that's what comes to mind when he wants to share his affection.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, to be fair, he didn't say the children. I don't want the QAnon folk to go crazy.
Oh, good point.
Although on a related note, he did respond. Someone tweeted him about how they're trying to take down Christopher Columbus and he's a great American. And Trump tweeted very positively about Christopher Columbus, who I'm an Italian, so I get to criticize Christopher Columbus. And I just think it's weird, as I tweeted earlier this morning, that in the days of QAnon and all the Save the Children stuff, that they are so committed to worshiping Christopher Columbus, who literally raped children and trafficked them as gifts to his workers. So.
Yep, and he wrote it down. It's in his own words in his journal, talking about 14-year-olds being highly marketable. And so it's like, why elevate this guy who was a pedo?
Yeah, yeah, I get it that Italy has had a rough 500 years or so. And so I get why we would want to hold up these supposed heroes of our past. But no, we're really striking out on all of them. We haven't produced much good outside of food in a long time. And I'm Italian, so I get to say that. Anyway, so look, he's out there and he's talking about going into the crowd and kissing people, which he's talking about. They say I'm immune. Nobody is saying that. Literally nobody but Trump is saying that. And again, he's talking to his audience. They are looking to him for knowledge about coronavirus. And he's doing what we worried when he was first diagnosed he would do, that one of two things would happen. Either he would die or he would use the experience to buttress the misinformation he'd already been spreading. And we are now deep into that. He's learned nothing.
Not a thing, no. And I do kind of love this energy. It reminds me very much of Charlie Sheen, Tiger Blood kind of thought. But I didn't want Charlie Sheen on my television. So I don't want Trump in my White House, but hey.
No. Well, I'll tell you what you're gonna get. You are gonna get a Trump dance party. Someone in the chat was asking, are they gonna show the video of Trump dancing? I mean, come on, we have to, here it is. Thanks, I hate it. Man, when you slow down Macho Man, it is a horror show. Anyway, Adrian, he's feeling better. He's feeling so good that he's dancing now.
You know what? He's on steroids. He's on whatever he needs to do so that he can perpetuate this image of hypermasculinity and being almost kind of a godlike figure who can't in any way be harmed. And it's very disturbing, especially given that he's going out of his way to corral people together during a pandemic and he's carrying the virus himself. Like how much more disturbing can that be?
Yeah, yeah. By the way, he was throwing masks out into the audience. People didn't wear them, which we're gonna get to, but he was touching things and then throwing out the audience. And it's a biological weapon, but people are treating like it wasn't. Yeah, somebody mentioned in Twitch that video was too low res for us to know, but I'm just gonna call it. He was definitely doing the overbite while doing that dance. And I will just say, like, if you as a political movement, you have the authoritarian personality, you just want a strong man, you hate democracy, fine. Get a strong man You don't get to be the hyper-masculine group and have that going on. It's not hyper-masculine. I don't know what it's hyper. It's hypersteroids, I guess. Not masculine, though. Not even like, it's not actual healthy masculinity. It's not even old school toxic masculinity. I don't know what that is. It's not any of them.
It's disturbing. That's what it is. But I would like to see which, you know, members of our legislature and lawmakers actually have moves. It'd be nice if someone actually broke it out and you were just like, damn, is this where we are today? That would be refreshing. I could use that in 2020.
Do you have any guesses?
Shucks. Oh, Lord. Some of them scare me. Yeah, no. AOC probably is beat. You know, I wouldn't be surprised.
Well, she's the only one we have video of.
Yeah, it's true.
That's maybe. Yeah. Maybe. We have her college days video that they literally thought that video of her dancing happily was going to take her down. We come from such different worlds, really. Such different worlds. But anyway, yeah. Oh, by the way, I do want to add one thing though. So we're having a little bit of fun and, you know, Trump is saying crazy things. He's dancing like a madman. But let me just say one thing that will cause the audience to probably be mad at me. It's like I was saying the whole time, look, for all that, it's totally true. He didn't learn anything. He's still spreading misinformation, but you can't say that he doesn't look recovered for the most part. Like, he may still be infected, but the guy did talk for a long time. He was yelling, he was sweating profusely and everything, but that's not new. Adrian, he looks like he's mostly recovered from having coronavirus.
I think that there are a lot of drugs that they can give you to kind of, you know, weaken it, Bernie's, prop you up. And those new stories that have really come out and emerged on JFK when he was having all of his health issues and the steroids and the concoctions that they gave him to literally prop him up so he could meet with other leaders and look spry and young. So I'm full shoulder shrugs. I don't believe it. And I also don't think it's right to be out here when you were just diagnosed with COVID, claiming that you're safe when CDC guidelines, World Health Organization says you need to quarantine for X weeks. And I think it's very irresponsible.
You are 100% right. Him doing it, Mike Lee going to those coronavirus hearings, Lindsey Graham refusing to get tested, so irresponsible. And I know that it's been very normalized over the last 7 months, but we got to keep pointing it out. We got to get through to as many people as we can. Let's talk a little bit more about health, though. There aren't a lot of reporters apparently following Trump on the campaign trail. That's like the new reporting of the last few days, is that they just don't think it's safe, so they don't want to do it. But CNN does have a reporter, Gary Tuchman, who went to yesterday's rally. And we've got two videos of Gary Tuchman that I really want to play because I think he did a great job. The first is his brief discussion of the level of COVID safety, the safety measures at that rally. Take a look.
Now, if you thought that people would be more careful at Trump rallies after hearing that Donald Trump had the coronavirus and that there was a super spreading event at the White House, you would be incorrect. Hundreds and hundreds of people lined up outside in the broiling sun for hours today here in Sanford, Florida. There was no social distancing, and I would say about 90% of people did not have masks. Everyone had their temperature checked, they were given hand sanitizer, and they were also given masks, but there was no mandate to wear them. And most of those masks were put in pockets or put in purses, never to come out again. We talked to a lot of people who decided not to wear masks.
So Adrian, like the campaign did what they've done. They, you know, made the things available that are necessary, but the people just aren't using them apparently.
Oh, well, yeah, we're gonna blame the people when he started, you know, from pretty much the jump back in March of saying, oh, we don't need these things, they're excessive. Also, we see that he doesn't consistently use a mask. He often takes it off. He's associated wearing a mask with masculinity, which is just too much irony that goes on there. And so he's already set up this base who they don't think they need masks. They think that they are infallible and that nothing's going to happen to them. So why should we expect them to wear it?
Yeah, you're 100% right. And actually, I'm glad that you said that about Trump's role in this, because when we play the next video, there's gonna be a direct shout out to that. Let me just briefly say, you know, I don't know if this video is even gonna be, if we're gonna be able to upload it to YouTube because it has music in the background. I don't go to Trump rallies, I never have. I need to talk to Emma. Is there a moment where they're not playing Macho Man? That wasn't the same moment, because it was dark in the dancing video, but they're still playing Macho Man. Have they listened to Macho Man? Do they understand the socio-political context around that? It's not saying what they think it's saying. Just like Born in the USA, listen to the lyrics of a song once in your life, right wing. You might learn something. Art is amazing when you try to understand it. But anyway, they're not gonna wear the masks. So that same reporter, Gary Tuchman, decides to ask them, why are you going to this rally maskless when the virus is everywhere?
House recently where so many people who were outside at an event got coronavirus, including the president ended up with coronavirus. That doesn't concern you?
No.
Why doesn't it concern you?
I'm healthy. I have no health, underlying health issues, and that seems to be the people that are most prone to getting the disease. If you have
the president was healthy too, though, and he had to take a helicopter to the hospital. Right? He had good medical care, right?
Yes. Well,
you think you'd have care that good?
I take care of myself.
Why not just put on a mask? What's the difference?
No, a mask can actually do more harm than good to individuals.
It'll do more harm.
It can, because people have almost can faint because there's too much carbon dioxide going back into their system.
That's a big problem. People fainting all over the country. For masks and dropping dead?
Well, it just enough. Enough people are getting ill because they're wearing a mask.
Really?
So, yeah.
Now, what Where did that come from, anyway?
Common sense.
Do you believe you won't get sick from it?
I don't care if I do, because I know I'm not going to die from it.
How do you know that, with all due respect?
You know what? If I do, I do. I'm not afraid.
I believe in God. And that's, I trust that if I get the virus, then that was God's will.
We've also seen the numbers drop every single day.
Well, the numbers are going up now, though.
In here.
I mean, Mr. Trump says it's disappearing, but it's not. That's not the truth.
Well, I'm debating on what the truth is for that, because of what I can see. It's all the numbers that I've read have been down, and I'm seeing that the flu is taking more people.
So that's what you believe?
Yes.
Let me ask you this. If President Trump at the rally said, everyone put on their masks, it's a good
thing. Put it on.
So that's the shout out there. She said if Trump just said to put on the mask, she would. I honestly don't think that most people at the rally would actually. I've seen video before of them saying that it wouldn't matter, that you really shouldn't wear one. But all we heard there, Adrian, was just a bunch of right wing talking points about carbon dioxide. It's your parents on Facebook. It's them repeating things that they heard. Like, they're full grown adults. Some of them are quite elderly, but they're not able to see through the propaganda that's been given to them by the president, by Fox News, by, you know, these sources on Facebook and stuff like that. They're willing to risk their life because of all of this BS.
And it's absolutely unfortunate that people are so greatly influenced by someone who doesn't have any intellectual capacity and has continued to show that he's in it for himself. And to take that person and make them your leader and to make health decisions based on what they say is extremely dangerous, yet people continue to follow Trump's words. And he is truly a role model.
Those people, what do we want to guess their average age was? 60s, 70s? Some of them look like maybe older.
Maybe 54.
Yeah, okay, maybe. But at least one or two of the people who were saying, I don't have any of the things that predispose you to getting it, which again, it's not predisposing you to getting it. It's predisposing you to die if you do get it. You are an elderly woman. You have literally the worst predisposition. You're elderly. It's killing the elderly. There was the other woman who said, I don't care if I get it because I'm not going to die. And he said, yeah, but a lot of people die. What if you die? Well, I don't care. Well, then you just don't care about anything. And the first woman, when he pointed out that she wouldn't get the medical care he would, she said, well, I'm not worried because I take care of myself. But you don't. You're maskless at a rally. That's literally the first step of taking care of yourself, is not willingly exposing yourself to the virus. And you haven't even passed that bar. Adrian, I don't know how stringent you've been for the past 7 months. But when I think back to what I've done and what I haven't done, like, I think about, so if I'm riding my bike, so I commute to work on a bicycle. And unless I'm passing near someone, I have my mask down. Like, that's a thing I think about. Should I still have it up even if I'm not near someone? These people are like, they're in a crowd of thousands of people. Like, the span of how compliant people are is so wide. And that's why we're looking at a possible third wave that's happening right now, because some people have been convinced that it's not an issue.
Yep, and they're gonna continue interacting and living their lives as if there is no global pandemic. And it's unfortunate just how much we're seeing this wave and movement toward the denial of science, which is unfortunate because I think before in the US, there was some big concern about the denial of religion and things you couldn't see. But when it comes to science, it was always thought that these are grounded facts. These are things we know to be the truth. And now people have completely relinquished all sense of reason for these things that were supposed to be kind of the base, could not be in any way removed or underpinned. And it is very, very scary when you can't get people to even understand facts.
Yeah. Something as simple as, does a mask cause you to pass out from carbon dioxide? What do they think the surgeons are doing, honestly? Like, they just believe it. They believe 7 months, there's been no evidence that it's actually affecting anybody, but they still believe it. They still believe that the flu is killing more people. It's just not factually true. It's just not true. It's not even close to true. It couldn't be less true. All the numbers I see are going down. What numbers? What numbers? Like the lack of interest on Fox News of talking about coronavirus, those numbers are going down. They don't really care to mention at all. The whole thing is just nonsense and people are dying as a result of it. People who are not gonna have, you know, the stem cell derived super medicines that Trump got access to for free through socialized government healthcare, they're not gonna get those things. They're gonna continue to die. Early voting has begun in any number of states, which means early vote waiting has begun in any number of states, with videos going around showing people waiting 3 hours, 9 hours, 11 hours. And those videos are so deeply depressing that in the richest country in the history of riches or countries, that we would force some of our citizens, not all of them, bear in mind, some specific citizens to wait for 11 hours. Adriana, have you seen those videos going around of the long lines?
I have, and I can't imagine because I don't wait in line for anything. So that's a hell of a thing to have to spend hours out of your day there.
Yeah, I can't conceive of it. The longest I think I've ever waited to vote was back at UConn for like an hour or two, maybe. And I live in Culver City, California. It takes me, once I think it took me 30 minutes. Sometimes I just walk in, I walk right in, I walk right out. Because it's not actually complicated if you put the money into it, you know, as a government. But when you don't, when it's particular areas and you have no interest in those people voting, then you get these incredibly long lines. And so I don't like waiting in lines any more than you do, Adrian, but those people have a difficult choice. Do they have their voices be heard or do they not? And the cost is significant for a lot of people that need to work. You know, they can't, it's not easy to take off 11 hours for anybody. But in addition to those long lines, we're also seeing some good news, but mostly bad news about people's voting rights. So originally in Texas, the governor done this thing where he was going to place a cap on one ballot drop-off box in every county, with a county being this interesting thing where some counties have 5,000 people, some counties have 4 million people, but they're each going to get one ballot drop-off point. Now, thankfully, a court overturned that and said you could have any number of those. Well, now we've reached the next iteration. In a ruling issued late last night, a federal appeals court upheld Governor Greg Abbott's order that limited counties to one mail-in ballot drop-off location. A three-judge panel of the 5th U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals, all appointed by President Donald Trump, rejected arguments from civil and voting rights groups that claimed Abbott's order suppressed voting rights by making it harder to cast a ballot, particularly for elderly and disabled voters who are most likely to use mail-in balloting. In reality, the judges said, Abbott expanded voting options by suspending a state law that allows mail-in ballots to be hand-delivered only on election day. So because he put the one in each county, he's actually awesome. The limit, let's not worry about that. He gave them one. Isn't that something, at least?
You know what? This would speak to why Amy Coney Barrett's originalism, textualism, kind of framework is problematic, because they're rigging the entire electorate system. And thus we end up getting these laws that just keep the oppression going. And then when you have judges who are like, I'm just gonna read it as it's written, it does not reflect the will of the people. And in this situation here, we have a stacked court that is very pro-Trump. And so of course they are going to create a situation in which those from minority communities or economically oppressed communities don't have full access to the right to vote, because we also have to remember they've drawn district lines, they've drawn county lines. They know what favors them, and they continue to push these laws, ordinances, and create these opportunities for them to stay in power by essentially suppressing the vote.
Yeah, it seems crazy to me that three judges that he gave their positions get to rule on possibly something that could affect enough votes that a state that is tied in polling right now and could totally determine the election hypothetically, they get to decide if people have an easy time voting or a difficult time voting. It's insane to me that's allowed, but it's allowed, and they love Trump, so why are they not gonna do that? Why not? There have been some states, by the way, multiple states have tried to limit ballot drop-off locations or the amount of time that they can be out there. In some states, I believe in Ohio, judges ruled that they could remain. And who knows? I mean, if the Supreme Court ends up taking up this one, which way are they gonna? I mean, you've already got two people on the Supreme Court right now as a result of Donald Trump. Who knows how they would rule on that? And if Amy Coney Barrett gets on in a week, if it makes it to her at that point, how would she rule? She definitely shouldn't rule on it at all, but she's not saying that she'll recuse herself. So the chance remains that she could get as involved as these three Trump appointed judges are.
Absolutely. And that's something that we all know, very much realize. And you know, Amy Coney Barrett's response this morning when asked if she would recuse herself, and her thought of, I need to talk it out with the other justices. If she actually means that and holds steadfast to it, I hope the other justices would say, nah, you need to sit this one out.
Yeah, you would hope. Now, in terms of everyone who hasn't necessarily gotten as far as the people who are trying to drop off their ballots in Texas right now, and you know, good luck if you're in Houston, because that's gonna be a long line, maybe tens of thousands of people long. What if you're just trying to register? You know, because there are deadlines for that. A lot of states have decided that you shouldn't be able to register the day of the election because they don't want you to vote, basically, and they want to make it difficult. So let's take a look at how it's been going on in a number of different states. In Virginia, breaking news this morning, an accidentally cut cable has caused the entire Virginia voter registration online system to go down on the last day to register to vote before election day. But don't worry, I'm sure they're gonna find the culprit, the rat who chewed through that cable. And I'm sure they're gonna extend the deadline to make up for the fact that people's ability to do so was taken away. What do you think, Adrian?
You know what? I love how that language is used, accidentally. It's just, it's like, how do you accidentally cut a cable that would essentially make this entire voting system go down? Yeah, right. Somebody structured this, of course, because it seems that the agenda has and always will be to suppress the vote. And there are a lot of people who are waiting to the last minute to vote. And those are generally the individuals who are most likely to be subject to oppression because they didn't have the information or the opportunities before to register to vote. And this is, it's just more unfortunate aspects of our system and how it does not operate as it purports to operate.
Exactly. And look, that's the most suspicious news I've ever seen in my life, that it just accidentally got cut or something. But let's say it is an accident. Who cares? Extend the deadline anyway. It doesn't matter. Like, it's definitely not an accident, but even if it is, people deserve the amount of time that they were supposed to be given to register. If that time has been taken away, it needs to be given again, especially when it may be an accident of the cable cutter variety in Virginia, but it's not working in other ones. I mean, if we jump ahead to Florida, the voter registration system crashed on the last day for filing. Pennsylvania's voter services website went down over the weekend as the deadline for mail ballots loom. Now, in those cases, let me be super nice and optimistic and say that it's just that a lot of people are trying to register and the system went down. Okay, this is why we're supposed to fund these things, so that they're robust and can take the added interest that we've known for 6 months there's gonna be because of a pandemic. And again, regardless of whether it's intentional that these systems have crashed or an actual accident, or if somebody stepped on a cable or knocked over a filing cabinet or whatever it is, you then have to extend the deadline so that people get the same amount of time. I don't think that that's unreasonable to request.
Nope, I don't think that it's unreasonable either. I just wish that the system operated as it purports to operate by actually wanting people to vote, and it does not. It wants to keep this system we have set up. So we kind of have this oligarchy where we got these people in power who are truly ruling us, and they don't want us peasants voting. No.
Yeah. We also have, I want to give a quick update to a story we talked about yesterday. Yesterday, we talked about the fact that the California GOP had placed a number of ballot drop-off boxes that they're not legally allowed to do. They have to be official ballot drop-off boxes placed by the county voting affairs office. They just put their own, and so that news broke. Since then, they've confirmed that it's theirs. And they have heard the California Secretary of State's warning that this is a violation of state law and said, cool, we're still doing it. They're just gonna keep doing this thing that they're admitting they did that is illegal because they wanna mess with the vote. Again, I don't even think that that's gonna be a very effective way to mess with the vote, but that's what they're doing. They've admitted it's them. They know that it's against the law and they're just gonna keep doing it because we have one party that sort of mostly wants to try to get people to vote for them, tries to be persuasive kind of in a really bad ways with huge blindsides and all that. And then one side that's just like, we're gonna stop people from voting. That's what we're gonna do. We're gonna do it in ways that are legal, ways that are illegal. We're gonna do whatever we want to make it so as few people as possible vote. And that's what we're seeing. In this segment, we've got California, Pennsylvania, Virginia, you know what, God knows Texas, all over the map. They're making it as hard as possible for people to actually vote.
Yep, and it's the thing that gets me the most is that we know that they put all these efforts in to disenfranchise people and to take away their opportunity to vote, and they continue to do it in part because there are no consequences for it. You rarely ever hear people getting prosecuted for trying to suppress the vote. And that is the biggest problem in my eyes, because we continue to hear this rhetoric about people voting twice and oh my gosh, oh, there's going to be so much fraud in voting. Why don't we focus on people suppressing votes and putting out these efforts like the GOP in California are doing to try to essentially seize other people's votes and to get in the way of their efforts? Let's focus on penalizing that behavior when we know that is statistically far more likely to happen and continues to happen.
Exactly. If their willingness to admit that they're doing it, which someone on Twitch called, they're not admitting it, they're bragging. Yeah, that's because they know who gets in trouble for this. There was that woman in Texas, I believe, who's like, she was sentenced to 5 years for accidentally voting in the wrong county or whatever when she wasn't supposed to. But the people who just every election, you've probably seen it. They send out, they'll go to Houston or something and be like, oh, a lot of interest in the election this year. So we're gonna have to stagger it. Republicans vote on Tuesday, Democrats vote on Wednesday. They do that every single year, everywhere across the country. Nobody goes to jail. That's why they keep doing it, because nobody goes to jail. We don't even have the money to protect the wires from being cut. I guess we don't have any enforcement authority to throw people in jail. But if on November 4th of every election, we were to do a long roundup of all of the people who are gonna be spending the next decade in jail for trying to rig an election, maybe that would stop a little bit of it from happening. That would be nice. Probably not gonna happen though. Kinda doubt it. Anyway, Adrian, thank you so much for joining us, especially today. I know you're probably gonna go back to following the hearings. Try to stay as optimistic as you've been so far, because it's gonna be rough. But thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
And by the way, before you go, everybody, keep Adrian here. Adrian's book is Staying in the Game, the Playbook for Beating Workplace Sexual Harassment. Everyone take a look at that. Adrian, where can people follow you and get your expertise and your perspective as these hearings go on?
So I am most active on Twitter at Adrian Law. And you can also find me smiling a bit on Instagram at Adrian Lauren.
Because as everyone says, you can't spell Adrian Lawrence without the law. Anyway, Adrian, thank you so much for joining us. Have a good one.
Take care.
So during the pandemic, being in college seems like it would be a very different experience than it was pre-pandemic, but you first have to get there. So let's talk a little bit about how the pandemic has affected the process of applying to college. And joining us to break it all down is the president and CEO of the Common Application and expert on education, Jenny Ricard. Welcome to the Damage Report.
Thanks so much, John. Glad to be here.
We're glad to have you here. So if you're, you know, a prospective college student out there and you're getting involved in this application process, what has 2020 done to that? How are things different?
Wow. Well, John, what it has done has it's disrupted the process from a variety of perspectives. First of all, one of the standards that students have been involved with over the years is standardized testing. And standardized testing in terms of the ability for the testing agencies to be able to administer the exams has been disrupted by the COVID-19, which then makes it more challenging for colleges and universities to get the names of students that they might recruit in that process. It has also led to more institutions deciding to remove standardized tests from their criteria, given the fact that so many students won't be able to have access to that, which is then creating, I think, some confusion and speculation on the part of students about, well, maybe I'll have a better chance of getting into a school if I don't have tests or if they're not looking at tests anymore. So the traditional criteria that students have been able to assess whether they might or may not get into a college is changing for them as well, because they're not going to have that same test score that's in the mix.
Yeah, very reasonable. What I'm wondering is, do we have evidence yet where we can say definitively how, you know, the disruption itself, the prospect that you might not be able to actually go physically to college that might influence people's applications? Do we have any idea yet of how much all of this together might be affecting not just like how many schools each student applies to, but whether they apply at all? Is this affecting the overall, like the number of people transitioning from high school to college this year?
Yeah, well, I'm worried in terms of this application season. We already know that there are declines in enrollments for this particular year in terms of students who got admitted last year who may not have enrolled this year or decided to delay their enrollment. But in the application process so far this year, our early numbers at Common App are showing a change and a decline for students. As of now, we have probably about a 5% decline in applicants for as of right now, which is significant because typically we added 40 new colleges to our membership this year. We have over 900 colleges and universities who are members of the Common App. And so to have a 4% decline when you've added is significant. And this is also the time of year when we typically have more applications, a higher increase, because it's the beginning of the school year and there are early deadlines starting October 15th and then November 1st that tend to draw a lot of applicants.
Yeah.
So to see that is showing to us that there are changes. We also have seen some declines in first generation college students and fee waiver eligible students. So that we're looking out for that.
Yeah, I'm glad that you mentioned that about the fee waiver students, because I mean I remember back a billion years ago when I was applying to colleges how expensive the process was, and we not only have the pandemic, we have tens of millions of people losing their jobs, and it's a significant expense. I know that there has been some education aid that was provided, you know, 6 months ago when the government last did something about the pandemic. Was there any money that was provided to ease the cost of going through this process? Was that a part of it?
That's a great question, and it would have been up to the individual colleges and universities to decide where they wanted to allocate that funding. But I do know, and I've seen just over the past couple of days, a number of schools deciding to waive their application fees this year. Don't have the data yet at Common App of our 900 members, but I do know that about half of our members already do not charge an application fee. And so the other half do. And to use the Common App, since we're a nonprofit membership organization, it's free for a student to use the Common App. It's the individual schools that charge application fees. So there was, I don't know if there was funding, there was not funding directly to that, but it's up to the institutions to make that decision.
Okay, that's a very important distinction to make. Now I know that there was a change made to the Common App this year. Could you walk us through that?
Yeah, definitely. You know, at this moment of reckoning about race and equity in education, we are taking it very seriously what our role might be as part of the system in terms of, you know, putting up barriers for students in terms of access. And so we've been looking at our questions on the application to make sure that we're not doing that. And if we are doing that, what changes can we make? And when you look at school discipline disproportionately impacts low income and students of color, particularly black students. Black and Latinx students black students are in K-12 are 4 times more likely to be disciplined than a white student. And that inequity can persist when you go into the college application process and there's a question about it. I think about the student who thinks the odds are already stacked against them, thinking that, you know, here's yet another thing, and they get to that question and they give up. Because school discipline has been shown when students are suspended, they're less likely to graduate from high school, less likely to go to college, and more likely to enter the criminal justice system. So when we did a review of external and internal data, we found, you know, what I just said about the disproportionate impact on black students, but also the fact that black and Latinx students for the same disciplinary issue are more likely to be removed from school than a white student. And our own data showed that students who answered the school discipline question were less likely to complete or submit their application.
Oh, wow.
And that the students who answered yes to that question, again, were disproportionately black and Latinx. So from our vantage point, removing that question from the common portion of the application is a step towards, you know, chipping away some of these, you know, this evidence of sort of systemic barriers that we have erected in the process. So we're looking forward to hopefully our members can still ask it on their own applications, but we're doing everything we can to educate them about this disproportionate impact on students of color and particularly black students.
That seems to make all the sense in the world, seems like common sense. And so in America, my spider sense goes off. What has the reaction been like since that change was announced?
Yeah, we just announced it. And the schools have been receptive. I've not actually gotten any pushback from institutions. We do have education sessions that we're providing. And our goal again is to have fewer schools choose to ask it on their supplemental portion of the common application. I can tell you that last year was the first year after which we had removed the criminal history question from the application. It used to be again a common question, but we removed it, and half of our members decided to ask it. So that means half of them chose not to. And so that's what we're really looking forward to, is having more of our members choose not to ask the student discipline question because of the impact that it has on a student even thinking, you know, about going to college. And we just can't have that, particularly today.
I agree. Any other significant changes being discussed going forward? You know, this pandemic might continue for some time. You know, what else is on the docket?
Yeah, we've got a number of things. In terms of changes to the application, on the list are citizenship as it relates to immigration and undocumented students, and how we might be asking that question in a way that could be having a chilling effect on undocumented students, and what can we do there? Religion is one of the questions, military discharge, family background, and then also gender identity and expression are some of the questions there. Also with the pandemic, we added a question this year for students who may have been impacted by the pandemic in terms of not having Wi-Fi to take classes, or not having a quiet space in their home, or needing to actually take care of siblings rather than being able to focus on, you know, their classwork. Wanting to be able to give students a place on the application where they could share that information without them having to use their essays or other aspects of the application to do so. We also had an initiative that I'm really excited about in terms of what it has done and what the potential is. In April, when we realized that students who'd already been admitted to college were going to be dealing with financial aid questions and not necessarily knowing what decision they should make, whether the college they're going to is going to be able to admit them or continue to give them financial aid, we partnered with a chatbot platform, AdmitHub, as well as College Advising Corps. And we identified nearly 200,000 students who are first generation, low income, or underrepresented, or likely to not have school counseling resources to connect them to this chatbot that could answer basic questions. But then if they had another question, connect them to someone at College Advising Corps, a real live person, to be able to give them more personalized advice. And what we found, and because it's still going on, is we had a 60% engagement rate with that chatbot. And you think about that, that it's typically about 15% when an individual college is reaching out to a student. And so the fact that we had a 60% engagement rate really spoke to us about the idea of sort of a neutral party providing guidance that is tailored to the student and making it very accessible to them, you know, right there in text messaging, can really make a difference. So we're excited about being able to have interventions like that, given the reach that we have, because over 1 million students apply to Common App every year using that platform, and 1/3 of them are first generation college students.
Wow. These all seem like very reasonable changes, especially considering, you know, some of the massive challenges that we discussed earlier. So, thank you for looking into this and helping to make it as easy as possible during the most difficult year for college applications, probably on record. Jenny Ricard, ever, exactly. President and CEO of the Common Application, Jenny Ricard, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much, John.
Thanks for listening to the full episode of The Damage Report. Support our work, listen ad-free, access members-only bonus content, and more by subscribing to Apple Podcasts at apple.co/TYT. I'm your host, John Adirola. I'll see you soon.